predominantly start forming, you're still okay. And that's one kind of nice thing about this approach.
But you're switching them to D, so you're making a ratchet slice,
yes,
weight in each galaxy, so each galaxy gets a weight, and then you just
exactly
create essentially a weight.
And then you have overlapping ratchet slices, they overlap by half, and then you reconnect through the ratchet slices after that. So what you'll typically see if I were to step through a few ratchet slices is that peak will brighten and then it'll go back down again. So you associate it, or you can connect those different detections and associate those all as being of the same system. And this is just an example slice at a redshift of 1.2 showing some of the higher overdensity peaks coming through.
I mean, the photometric redshift is really the task for the red galaxy.
Actually, not so much, because the way it works out with the blue photometry that we have in the optical, you end up with fairly similar P of Z uncertainties of higher redshift dense. Where you actually have the most trouble is due to some template mismatches is right down here. But then, as I said, after you get back to 1.5 or so. So what we've been doing actually now is there's now the Spitzer Deep Wide Field Survey data for this entire region, which is improves the depth relative to the IRAC shallow survey, and I did a near-infrared survey in JH&K over the full region. It goes about a magnitude and a half deeper than what we had before.
Is SURF? You're talking about SURF?
No. No, the IRAC data is the Spitzer Deep Wide Field Survey, or SIDWIS. And the new firm survey, and we put the paper out, but we're calling it IDIS, Infrared Duties Imaging Survey, successor to the negative survey. With that should clean up the photometric redshifts all the way well past redshifts of 2, close to 3 actually, so that we can more robustly get the stuff at high redshift. And from that, we did a first pass catalog. We're still working on cleaning stuff up, and we about tripled the number. And I've also had a student with me working on a friends of friends based algorithm that we've been doing as comparison to the wavelets, and the comparison actually turns up quite nicely. And then also in conjunction with that, we've been comparing both the algorithms, but primarily his friends of friends algorithm with some mocks from RISA. And she's getting us a new version of the mocks soon because there was something a little goofy. But it looks like when you compare the mocks that the redshift, the mass limit you get as a function of redshift is, as we expected, fairly independent of cluster redshift out for about a half. And I'll show you another way of looking at that in a second. So you're getting a fairly constant mass threshold going out, and you're getting well down below 10 to the 14 for this new survey. So just to give you a little sense what the redshift distribution is looking like, this is a plot that I remember last summer Gus has seen and was amused by us. This is our not cosmology plot, but those are just some lines overlaid that are Shep-Torman to give you a sense, and these are just different significance thresholds. This is our full catalog, and you just cut at a few different thresholds. You can try to get at what the mass limit is in assorted different ways. You can look at what the correlation, the cluster-cluster correlation is. You can just say, let's assume for a second that we're getting this number density if we take a WMAP cosmology and we invert it to get what mass threshold that would correspond to, what does it look like? And I'll show you a figure actually from a proposal that was just going in that shows what happens if you do that, which is you get pretty flat mass limit, and this is from the original shallow cluster survey, not the new stuff, where you're getting about down to 8 × 10⁻³ once you get to a redshift of a half. And if you look at what the clustering is telling you, it's saying you're right about in that same range as well. So essentially, that's roughly what our limit is from the first pass survey. With the deeper survey, I'm expecting us to get down to more like 5 × 10⁻¹⁴. Or 13. Yeah.
What is your actual, you do the mesh filter approach, but what's your resistance measure, I guess, or what's the limit of, what's the signal?
Right. So what I'm showing you, right now is just the significance of the peak. So nothing more than that. I'll talk about richness measures and such in a second, but this is nothing more than how significant are the peaks in your density map, which, at some level you can think of as going back to your question the other day of, do we have to define a cluster if we define the piece? What were you going to say?
How are you using the clustering for this?
We look at the cluster-cluster angular correlation function as a function of
So it's basically the bias of a function of mass that is what you can vary there, or the scattering dimension to move the correlation, right?
Say that one more time. I missed the last part of that.
But the question for the clustering is like by a square times power spectrum. So by is that the variable that you can vary to make the clustering curve move around? Is it the mass of your sample, the scatter of your sample, pretty much?
Yeah.
Right. So right. That's your feeling. That's just
more or less.
Have some assumption for bias.
Yeah. Well, we can go into a little more detail, but more or less.
Can you just summarize the bounds that you're working with again?
Yeah. So from IRAC, we're using 3.6 and 4.5 microns. We're not using the longer wavelengths. And then we have BR and I from NOAA Deep Wide. And now with the newer work, we have JH and K to add to that as well. So.
And so the weight for each galaxy is it proportional in some way to heat rate luminosity?
Only in the sense that as you get to fainter galaxies, their probability distributions get broader because you don't have the data constraints.
So the significance is proportional to the number of galaxies and not to the stellar mass in the system.
Right. Correct. Actually, the one other thing that I should note that I didn't is that I am applying in this fixed cut relative to L-star so that you're not going way down the luminosity function at low redshift.
Okay.
So that you're actually looking at the same galaxies as you go out.
What about if you weigh by stellar mass? I mean, because in principle you can gauge stellar mass a little bit, right, from your data in the galaxy.
Yeah, you can.
Maybe not in absolute, but relative terms.
Yeah, we haven't tried that. That's a good question, but we haven't tried it.
And also, when it comes to mass, in optical catalogs, usually you immediately hear two words, purity and completeness.
Yeah, purity greater than 90%.
So it's a function of mass, right? So purity and completeness is a function of mass.
Down to our detection threshold right now. So, and I say that based on two.
Down to that mass. So I wonder how to connect it to this mass.
Yes, so. down to that mass. So I'm saying that based on a combination of two things. You can come back at me later if this is proven wrong later. But if you ask for the high redshift clusters that we've targeted at Keck, how are we doing in terms of the follow-up? And we've confirmed all but one of the ones we've targeted, maybe two. There might be one where we didn't get much data. So we're, I think, sitting between 90 and 95% success rate on the spectroscopic follow-up right now.
What does it mean confirm?
You go and you get redshifts, and you put a slit mask on the target cluster. And we call it confirmed if you get, I think our basic definition is 5 or 6 within 1,500 kilometers per second or something like that. But we're trying to get at least 10 or 15 for each one.
I guess what I meant by purity and completeness is, for example, if you test it on a mock catalog.
So that's the other thing.
You recover the real clusters, to what fraction of the real clusters would recover. And
right.
How many of you would sink a cluster? Which
right, so that's the other half of the question, and the full answer to that will depend on when we get Risa's mocks back, the new version of her mocks back. From the mocks we were testing on, we were 100% complete, I want to say, to maybe 10 to the 14.1, and then the fall off in completeness is consistent with if you fit it with an error function. What that number is for what the midpoint of the error function depends on the mocks. So I think it's going to go up, but when we were doing it before, it was about 13.5, 13.6 in log mass.
These are sparkle over in
Yeah, pretty sure. Actually, now that I say that, I'm not pretty sure. I should check that.
I think they're SO200 masses, that's canonical.
Do we have the information to construct reliable mock catalogs in this redshift range?
No.
We're iterating with RISA. Yeah. So that's part of where we're iterating back and forth right now.
Reliability do you want?
Yeah. So
yeah, something to turn purity into a rating.
Yeah. So she and her student sent us catalogs, mock catalogs for their simulations. Actually, the simulations we'd gotten from her before only went up to 1.1. And we're waiting to get some to go up to 1.6 or so. So the original ones that she had sent looked great in the Sloan bands, which is where they were really designed for. And then we were iterating back and forth because in the IRAC bands, the number counts were way off and such. So we're iterating between our groups. What we're seeing, though, is actually where we get down isn't dramatically sensitive, it turns out. So we'll see that if that statement holds, but it seems reasonably robust. So.
Just one other technical thing, sorry.
Sure, please.
With your the PhotoC versus SpecC plot, with these bands, were you significant? Did they look split? Were you were those bands able to get rid of most of the outliers that would normally
that's
be?
That's not clipped, actually.
That's actually.
So it's a Gaussian distribution about the mean.
Pretty much. Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Not clipped.
Same with the long arrows. What are those dashed lines?
The dashed lines correspond to the photo zeros for the galaxies, and then this is just the RMS that you're getting for the clusters. So the dotted lines should be the one sigma more or less on the clusters.
Well, it looks like three sigma because there's no lot of
noise.
No, the inner
dotted lines. So what was it that made the difference in getting rid of the outliers that will plague an optical survey, say going up to J?
The outliers, well, on the cluster edges?
Yeah, is it having the IRF bands that remove the outliers? Or?
The IRF bands help a lot, and the fact that you're combining together the POZs for all the galaxies associated with that overdensity. So.
Oh, this is for clusters.
This is for the clusters.
Oh,
it's not for individual galaxies.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, no, if I'd done the galaxies, you would have seen plenty of outliers about those lines. Right. But the fact that you've got that whole cluster to add together really helps you out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of fun that way. So I mentioned before, this is actually from a proposal that Adam Stanford was PIing that just went into Spitzer. So the idea, and this kind of ties back to our discussions the other day, is to target 100 square degrees in the SPT pole region, where that's going to be their deepest field. This is the limits they're expecting from SPT deep, and then this is what they're expecting from SPT pole. And the entire area is also being covered with Herschel, with Pax and Spire. A quarter of it is supposed to be targeted with XMM by the XL, or XXL. And then we're going to add IRAC and DES, I know is covering the region too, and there's some ACT coverage as well. So the whole goal of that really is to be able to compare all the different methods of detection in the same region to try to start getting a little better statistical handle on things. And then since we're able to go decently below in mass what's going to be attained for individual clusters here, what you can do is you can start constructing samples if you have a reasonable, or constructing samples from the IRAC data to start looking at what the stacked X-ray properties are, or the stacked SC properties are going down. And we do have a smaller region already within this area, it's 12 square degrees of Spitzer data, where in the last couple of weeks, the student I mentioned working with me, his name is Dan Gettings for future reference, went ahead and did a search through there, and we stacked on his high significance, high redshift peaks. And then Mark Broadwin has been doing a comparison of the SZ signal versus IR richness measure, basically. Number of galaxies within 500 megaparsecs, something simple for now that can be refined. And it's actually shockingly promising. So this is mass a la Vanderlin 2010 for the SZ versus a log of the number of galaxies within that aperture, counting from M star plus one. And this is the stacked data in SPCS. Only one data point, so make of it what you will, since if you remove that data point, you've got some leverage here. But the idea is hopefully if we get this, we can start populating this directly down to about here and doing some stacking down further as well. But if you calculate the scatter, it's on the 30% level compared to SD, which is, I would say, not horrible. So,
has anybody taken a look at, once you start getting down into the lower masses there, you're gonna have some scatter that's skewed in the SD signal. You should. Mm-hmm. Because of blind side effects and these kinds of things.
Right.
So at the top end where you're looking, it's not there's almost none of that. But as you get down into the lower masses, it will certainly show up, or it should show up.
Right. So has anybody yet? No.
Okay.
As I said, this was done in the last week and a half in advance of proposals.
And what's the time scale for the SPT survey getting down into those mass ranges?
So if you talk about SPT deep, I think they said the data's in the can right now. SPT pull goes on the time scale of about a year. So I think within 2 years it should be there. So, and then, yeah. kind of what's going on that side of things in terms of the cluster searches, and there's a lot of work to be done here to figure out what the best way to do an infrared proxy for mass is and cross-compare things, but I thought that was kind of a fun start. The other fun thing we're doing right now, as I was mentioning before, is actually starting to do follow-up on some of these clusters. And actually, even before the follow-up, one fun thing that you can do is start stacking the data sets and looking at statistical properties. This is, and we talked about this a little bit before, this is a figure from Yanting Lin a few years back where he's looking at the K-band luminosity compared to different formation models as a function of redshift. And all the data at that point pretty much agree that you're not seeing any real evolution after a redshift of about one.
Is this K-band luminosity or what?
A K-band luminosity of an L-star galaxy. So if you fit luminosity functions and you ask what is K-star, that's what you get. So a student with me, Connor Mancone, went ahead and did the same thing at 3.6 and 4.5 microns. So 3.6, 4.5, and then fit Bruce-Walsh, Charlot, Marston, CBO7 models. And if you look at the residuals, what you'll see is out to about a redshift of 1.3, everything looks beautiful. After that, and this is still a little tentative because, as I said, this is where our photos start getting a little worse. It does look like you're starting to have a departure where things are getting fainter. So we're working on following this up. Well, now that we have better photos coming in from the new data set, we're going to revisit this analysis. But it's looking interesting. And then, as I mentioned before, also Mark Broadwin is working on following up the LIRGs. So here's an image of one of the clusters at 1.37, where here red is IRAC, blue is B, and I believe that green is I right now. But you see the cluster here. If you look at 4.5 microns, again, this is where it's really coming out, so why you've got the red over density there. If you look at 24 microns, this is the interesting thing, that you're seeing the same central concentration here at 24 microns that you're seeing in the IRAC data, arguing that you've got some centrally concentrated star formation in this cluster, and this seems to be something we're seeing in a lot of the high redshift clusters that we have NIPS data on. And there were papers by Hilton and Vitran recently where they're seeing the same things at a redshift 1.5 in their data set as well. So
if you convert this to a star formation rate,
All of these are LIRGs or above, so LIR is 10 to 11, 100 star, 100, now what is our limit actually? I don't remember our exact limit, but something on the order of 100 solar masses per year, roughly.
Is that confirmed by your optical spectroscopy? You see strong, what would you see here? O2?
The ones that we have spectroscopy for, yeah, we've got runs coming up in the spring at Keck where we're going to specifically target these and try to get a better handle on things. But the ones that we're targeting, or that we have spectra from its source in the past, are showing consistent pictures in the optical data image. So it does really appear that by redshift 1.5, we're getting to the point where you are seeing decent ongoing star formation in the center, in the galaxies near the core of the cluster. That's kind of fun. And what these are is just some HST images that we have showing what the morphologies of some of those star-forming galaxies look like. So you can see mergers and
formation details.
Yeah. The challenging environment to follow up star formation intents. And then those are rough stellar masses for what these systems are looking like. So they're reasonably massive systems that we're talking about here, too. And this is more or less, I mean, in the previous plot, I didn't really emphasize this, but if I jump back through here, the best fit formation redshifts for this range, if you're assuming a single burst model, are somewhere around a redshift of 2 to 3. So if you think of these in the same picture, that would mean we're kind of catching the tail end of the star formation here as it's shutting off after that peak era of star formation, or some remaining bit going on.
Are you going to share the red sequence at all? What I remember from some of the published work here is that there's still a prominent.
Yes, there is still a prominent red sequence. Yeah. So it's certainly not all the galaxies going off here.
Yeah.
I froze there, so let me reset here. So in complement to this, while Mark is working on the high redshift star formation, I had a, that's interesting. I don't even know how I did that.
Change to say you might turn your computer around.
All right. Well, we can have time here. And that's weird. Okay. Let me see if I can.
You just have to change the master display. Yeah. So we're going to display and drag the white bar from one to the other. And that should, that'll fix it.
But how did that just change by itself?
That's a really good question. So an arrangement of that.
There's options.
Mirror displays then. Yeah. Just mirror.
Or you could just mirror. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, let's do that. Watch it mirror the user part. All right. So in conjunction with the stuff, Mark's kind of been leading the high redshift of the star formation. I've had a student working with me, Sun Chung, who's been looking at data from WISE, where she's basically taken all the clusters from Ken Ryan's Sears sample to have caustic infall data mapped out, or velocities mapped out, and infall masses plus membership. And she's been looking to see what the distribution of star formation is in local clusters, so you can kind of get a more detailed picture of the endpoint in terms of the star formation. And while she does see that what you would expect in terms of rising star formation going out, and still rising even up to about three times the virial radius, if you look as a function of mass, she's not seeing a very strong trend. And this plots for things that are about half a lurg, and this is kind of our selection function here, but below our sensitivity limit. I'd follow the green line, really. So, and this is all very much work in progress right now, she's writing the paper. And then that's things for that are down by about a factor of three in luminosity. So what you're seeing is going down to about 5 × 10^13 solar masses, there's not a significant trend in the total star formation rate divided by the mass of the cluster. It's kind of a global specific star formation rate. And I think this actually kind of makes sense.
So I understand the lines linked to the points. I don't understand.
It's a little crazy right now. So as I said, not publishable yet. The green here is just linked to the data points there. That's showing the median trend of all the different clusters. So each data point here is a different cluster in the sample. And then this is the median star formation rate in each bin. And then this is just for a subset that are at high galactic latitude where the WISE data is a bit more complete. And I think what's kind of interesting is if you compare this with work from Michael Balog and McKee, last year, they were also seeing a fairly flat passive fractional equally as you go down to groups. So kind of seeing a similar trend at this time in the star formation rate rather than the SDSS type passive fraction. So I've been spending more time focusing on star formation type topics lately. I don't know.
So there's still a fraction, there's not a very strong function of mass, right? So you, can, yeah. You cannot have a very different star formation rate.
Right.
It's sort of consistent.
Yeah. So it's nice when things pull together. I don't know how long you want me to talk, or I can talk as long as short as we go. Should I go on to another topic?
Sure. All right. Can I ask you, going back to the high redshift did you ever, are there any interesting examples of blue clusters, entirely blue, very rich clusters that we have?
I'd say no. I think there is a general trend towards less and less of the galaxies being on the red sequence as you go higher. But I wouldn't, I don't recall anything in the literature about particularly blue clusters.
I mean, I'm just curious as to the methods that focus on red sequence cluster finding versus your, versus the method that's, ignorant about that in the sense of just using photoses. You know, one would wonder if the reason you use photoses was to be able to pick up systems that would potentially be, say, absent the way of
Right. So I would tend to say after redshifts of 1.2 or 1.3, people aren't seeing dramatic changes in scatter the red sequence, say. And you still have decent red sequences. Beyond that, there's tentative evidence, I would say, that the scatter is starting to come up, but it's still reasonably small. But your contrast is going down because your fraction of galaxies on the red sequence is going down.
You guys can characterize that.
I agree. We have a student working on the scatter aspect.
Actually, you need this for realistic catalogs.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Here's
an eighth question. Talking about the scatter of the red
sequence.
We're talking about the scatter of the red sequence among galaxies that are on the red sequence.
Exactly. Yes.
So what does that statement mean?
What that statement means is that galaxies should have a bigger spread in their colors within the some period after hitting the red sequence,
right.
So giga-year, more than a giga-year. So,
but when you're observationally trying to choose your galaxies that are close enough to the red sequence to be called red sequence galaxies, how is that done?
Right. The standard method that's been done in the field is you fit your red sequence and then you pick a delta magnitude, say 0.3 magnitude. So you say if it's within that, it's on the red sequence.
All right. And then so after you've done that, is now what's the scatter?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
But there,
Yeah, if you, on the other hand, ask what fraction of the galaxies in your cluster are within that point three.
Yeah, so it's changing. So,
yeah.
So I'm
that's
not sure
I'm
asking the right question
of.
Here.
Yeah, and no, I understand.
Yeah.
I agree. But.
Yeah, but you can do a Gaussian mixture model. I mean, John Rankow has an approach to just summing the two Gaussians and coming up with a, you know, red and a blue to represent a red and a blue. And there are degeneracies that especially certain redshifts for certain color combinations.
Right, now you have to be a little trickier than that, don't you, though? In the blue, your Gaussian, in terms of the amplitude, has to be a function of magnitude as well.
I think the Gaussian mixture will throw any distribution at it, and it will choose how many Gaussians it needs.
Okay.
And so it will tell you.
In the extreme, right.
It will tell you what is the underlying distribution in terms of Gaussians.
Right.
So it will try to identify, it will essentially fit your distribution in your color space.
Right.
With several Gaussians. And if two is enough, it will fit with
sure.
Three is needed.
Right, right. Now I guess what I was getting at more is that the fraction that you get in the blue Gaussian and the red Gaussian, you need to step through magnitude. Since the magnitude distributions of the two populations are going to be reasonably different, which you can do. It's not a. Yeah. All right. OK, so I'll throw this up here just for a minute. I'm not going to spend time on this. We can talk about this in the discussion section later. This is just a plot from last summer. I want to note Alexei's work, and I forget who was working with.
Student,
so the different groups that are looking at the stellar baryon fraction versus M500 are getting data that's reasonably consistent. We're all coming out kind of in the same region. One difference between here and here is really inclusion of ICL, although Z does have some ICL inclusion in there. So really where we need to push better though is down here still as well. One thing I've been working on actually is there was some concern, particularly from Michael Balog, about the fact that the way we were getting masses here is admittedly very rough, and that we had velocity dispersions, and then we were taking those and going through the relation from that we derived from some of Alexei's clusters between dispersion and X-ray temperature or X-ray mass and getting there that way. So Suresh Sivanandam, who's a student, or was a student with Dan Zavodoff, he's at Toronto now, was going eating some XMM data for some of these. And Trevor Ponman and Alistair Sanderson had gotten XMM data for a few. And if you take their data point, or their masses, and recalculate R500 and put the data points back on here, this is actually a little older, so don't take this as rough. These data points have moved a bit. So these scatter a bit in different directions, but they're more or less still on the relation. There's one oddball from Alistair's work, which I still don't really understand how this is happening, but work in progress too. So so the basic takeaway is that the stellar masses
So below it's for the same clusters for which you have both measurements, right?
Yeah, well, so, yeah, actually, the thing I should emphasize here is what we've done before is we took Alexi's clusters, which are different than the clusters we had stars for, and we corrected these using this relation. Now what we've been doing with these is we've been getting the XMM data for the actual clusters we had. So these points on here are ones where you actually have XMM data plus the stellar contribution as well. So if you draw your eye to just the purple points here, the purple points here, those are the ones where we have full accounting of the baryons in individual systems right now.
And so our data points in the previous pool, they both have Chandra data for those particular clusters and stellar muscles
We should sit down, put those together, and have our comparison plot for everything. That'd be great.
So I have a question about stellar masses.
Yes.
So I read in the New York Times that the
Peter's stuff. Yeah, I'd actually be curious to have a discussion about that. Let Mark go.
Well, okay, so
I put the question about this into your discussion with the wiki. So
okay, excellent.
Well, yeah, so there's claim that the IMF, or well, actually not the IMF, well, the MF mass function,
right,
in large elliptical galaxies actually has a pretty steeper than Saltpeter power law.
Right.
Indicating that there could be a lot more stellar mass there, that actually light that had been attributed to giants is actually mostly from dwarfs, and so there might be the stellar mass in large elliptics could be quite a bit larger.
Right.
Factor of hard to say.
Yeah. I think the New York Times one was 3.
Well, that was a number. I think that was a stellar number, so the mass factor is less.
Okay. Sure.
But anyway, and this has to do with the presence of spectroscopic features in the near infrared that are deep and prominent if the light is from dwarfs and not so deep and prominent from giants, since they see
right.
prominent absorption.
The wing board feature, and I'm forgetting which the other line was.
Carlson H.
There's a magnesium. Yeah, I can't remember. But there are these features.
Yeah.
indicating that a lot higher proportion of the light is from dwarfs than
right.
was anticipated.
Right. So now I'm speaking completely for myself. But I read that and I was pretty skeptical for this reason. If you go back and you look at the results from Capillari et al. for the Sauron data, their 2006 paper, what you see is that they're saying in the centers, if you look at the mass to light ratios, that explains about 70% of the dynamics with no need for additional, or so you'd only need about 30% dark matter. So if you're going to increase the mass by more than about 30%, you're going to then start being inconsistent for those elliptical galaxies with the dynamical data. So maybe you can comment on this.
I asked that exact question because I was surprised that they didn't comment on this in their paper. So I asked this exact question to Charlie Conner, and his answer was that if you look carefully at capillary data, what you say is true for lower mass ellipticals, but it's not true for the most massive ones in their sample. The most massive ones were actually indicating quite a bit of additional mass.
Okay. How much?
In addition to what you expect from the stellar population. I don't remember exactly, but they were well above the line, much more so than most of these lower mass ellipticals.
Okay.
And so they were careful to say that their evidence is for massive ellipticals because that's where they look.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that it's not, if you look carefully at the most massive thing in capillary sample, their results are not inconsistent with dynamical measurements.
Okay, we'll be interested in discussing
that. And I know also he said that they're busy getting more data for other clusters for more galaxies to mm-hmm. test this. Okay.
So then you're going to need to have, go ahead.
No, so does that help with the baryon problem then, since most of the stars are...
You know, you have to increase it for a significant fraction of cluster mass by a factor of 2 or so. It would help a lot, of course.
I guess the indication here is it's a mass-dependent mass-to-light ratio.
Right.
So you'd have to somehow break down your galaxies by mass.
So
you're not even so much break them down by mass, but have a continuous... Like it's unclear, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those plots, the mass to light ratio you assumed for calculating the stellar mass, I think it was a factor of like 2 above the what you get from Charpentier.
It was a bit higher than it was a bit higher. I have to look.
I think it was. Yeah. Anyway, so this, you know, factor of three more stars compared to what type of wide map.
I think the claim was compared.
No, yeah. I think the claim was. I think it was, yeah, so the claim was it's even steeper than Saltpeter's, but it's more consistent than Saltpeter's. Okay, so I think the IMFs, the if you reformulate the one Dalcom and then Chavez results in terms of mass to light, it's quite in line with this what Anthony assumes here in the linear time. And it would be in line with Soron. Assuming that most of the delta, most of the mass in Soron is
we should print this out for this afternoon.
Yeah, I think this is definitely something in discussion.
If you could just walk us through the bottom panel again with your specific colors.
Okay, so if you take these red data points for the X-ray gas and you apply the relation that you derive from the stars to those points, just the relation, not a point-wise, then you get the black points. So the black corresponds to the red here once you correct for the stars. The purple here are you taking the actual stellar measurements and the associated XMM measurements, and you're adding those together and plopping them on. And the yellow are the same for the Sanderson and Plotman two clusters, or groups, as it were.
So if you just extrapolated both lines and into the lower mass, that's actually, for the really low mass, for example, 10 to 13, that's actually going to go above the WMAP.
Right. If you extrapolate.
I've done this, actually, goes at about 2 or 3 times 10 to 13, it goes well above sharply short trees.
Yeah, we actually have systems that were lower down here, but I intentionally never plot them because until we actually have X-ray masses, the R500s are sufficiently uncertain that if you're systematically off on your R500, that's going to drive you all over the place here.
Also, we know that there should be a peak in stellar fraction somewhere between 10 to 12 and 10 to 13, right?
Yeah,
and
we know that that peak, 13,
that peak seems to be 30%, 40%, something like that, most.
It would be really interesting to map 30, that turnover. Yeah.
So this line cannot continue, right? It has to peak and then decrease. Right?
Well, on this plot, it reaches 50% at 6 or 5 times.
Yeah, so that was my other question that should be for this discussion, is that I think if you look at Halo abundance matching constraints, their plots as a function of mass make no sense from the perspective of this plot because they peak at 20%, so 25%, at masses about 10 to the 12, whereas clusters in groups indicate that there's 50% peak at masses 10 to the 13, and there's somehow disconnect between the two, which needs to be reconciled.
Are you concerned about the individual magenta point seems to be a little low?
Yes and no. Yes, concerned when this plot was made. As I said, I grabbed this quickly. This has evolved since I made this plot. So things are looking a little more sensible these days, but I haven't actually plotted it.
This is your bias.
I'm about to say that.
Or is this also bias that the results due to the functional plot?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that you look at that and go, that's interesting. No, in the sense that the X-ray analysis is being done separately from the stellar analysis here, and the reason we went back wasn't because of this as much as because of a few other issues that needed to be addressed. But at some level, I have to say yes, to be fair. It's not completely valid.
So which one is that, a yellow one down the bottom?
Yeah, that's this one. So. They've been working on this, and they were getting an unusually low gas fraction, which I don't really understand why at this point. So if you take a really low gas fraction, a very low gas mass, it ends up driving you just a little bit off on this relation, but if you try to add that up, you're obviously down by a large amount, so.
But you can, some clusters may suffer from projection effects, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, it's hard to separate. You may be unlucky and get another poor cluster projecting close by, in spatially, spectroscopically close by in velocity space, and then you get very large stellar mass and still with normal gas mass because that doesn't.
Well, no, but if you look at the gas fraction, though, I mean, there's the gas fraction compared to the relation up here. So you're getting.
Right, so this may be generally not very massive cluster, and then you just happen to project like a group that you don't see in X-rays, but adds a lot to the stellar mass. See what I mean?
So but the stellar mass doesn't come into that part at all.
Is it just mass?
That's just gas mass over the total mass you're getting.
That's right, but stellar. Oh.
It's too low.
Yeah, no, it's this point should be somewhere up there if it's like other things.
It's the gas.
So.
Is there any reason to believe that the temperature is abnormally high?
Yeah, we've had a discussion going on back and forth, but I don't
think. It's an underwater system.
Yeah, do you remember what is it?
I can tell you a little later.
I think it was able 262. It's
not 262. It's either
FGS.
It's either 2455 or it's one of. I get the two that they did confused. So I can look it up afterwards and tell you.
You could potentially get this from the line of sight merger, though, right? Couldn't you? Because then you're not the gas isn't hot enough. For the mass, and so if it's not merged yet, it's approaching line of sight merger. You might not pick that out in the velocity space, but you wouldn't see that. It wouldn't be X-ray underluminance for its mass.
You can also check.
I think that should work.
Well, the mass is just X-ray.
Yeah, that's why. It's all X-ray based. So.
Right, but that, all I mean is that the gas wouldn't be as hot or dense as it would be when it's finished.
No, but when you estimate the mass from
the total mass is also coming from here.
Oh yeah, the total right here. Okay.
But go back to the lower mass, I mean, because the Giordini, that the cosmos basically extend to 10 to the 13 solar mass group. So those stellar mass actually stellar fraction is pretty high. So if you combine with the previous plot, but
I can actually do this.
Yeah. But it pales, I mean, the group on the large radii, the surface brightness is still pretty flat, I mean, density actually pretty flat. So that indicates if you go from 500 to 200, I mean, that's, the gas fraction can increase a lot. So it seems that it could easily go to WMAP, the baryon fraction, and the low-mass halo.
Yeah, I am not a strong advocate for the argument that we're having a serious problem there with that bit of a difference.
And the problem arises because simulations predict that baryon fraction within 500 should be within 10% of that WMAP.
Right, but so if we look here.
Because the simulations of the WMAP.
Yeah, so we're a bit below that 10% as well, but this is something I enjoy talking with Alexei about too, is what everyone thinks the appropriate level of systematics really is right now for the different X-ray data sets. So, I mean, if it's supposed to be 10% low and we're 20% low right now, I'm still not completely convinced. I should be worried about that.
But the semantics to know about like hydrostatic mass estimates actually would revise these fractions down, not up.
Well, the part I'm really interested in is understanding how you establish these two trends together and get that trade-off with mass.
10% low from non-thermal pressure support.
Yeah, any non-thermal pressure support would be revising the points down, actually. So yes. They would be overestimated. So that's a nice segue into discussion.
Maybe we should just pause there.